Hey everybody, it's me, Camille.
And me, Tim. Welcome back.
To season two.
Season two.
We live here. I mean, we've been gone for a minute.
We've been gone for a little bit.
Yeah, but we're so excited to be back with you guys and to share what we've been up to.
All right, so I've been thinking about how we start season two and start this episode, and here's what I came up with.
Mm-hmm.
Ask Camille a random question.
Oh my gosh. You know, that sounds really familiar.
I wonder why that sounds familiar.
It's kind of how we start all our story meetings.
Right, right. Okay, so ready for your random question?
I'm ready.
Have you ever been told a story you just did not believe?
Oh yeah. I mean, all the time. It's kind of an occupational hazard.
So I figured you would say that because, like you just mentioned, as journalists, we have this attitude, this professional ethic even, that you just don't really believe people.
Right. Trust but verify.
Never assume.
If your mother tells you she loves you, check
it
out.
Yeah. All that good stuff our journalism professor said. But here's where I'm going with this. All right. So like we've been talking, this push and pull between people, who you believe and who you need extra proof from, it happens a lot and it doesn't really matter what you do for a living.
Yeah. And for some people, this burden of proof, if you will, that they're telling the truth is much, much higher.
People don't listen to poor people. They don't listen to black people in America, and if you're poor and black, almost no one listens to you.
This is Thomas Harvey. He's a lawyer here in St. Louis.
And for a while, he too had a hard time believing poor people and black people.
Then something inside of him changed.
So, on this episode, we bring you the story of how that happened and what came next.
Because the change in Thomas's worldview and his heart and mind about race, class, and believability had a domino effect.
And ultimately helped lead to one of the biggest public policy changes post-Ferguson. We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems, and the people they touch.
I'm Camille Stanley.
And I'm Tim Lloyd. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
All right, season two officially starts now. We are back.
Which is just cool to say.
Very cool, very cool. But since we're going to be spending a lot of time with Thomas, we should get to know him a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's not one of these lawyers who read every John Grisham novel and knew exactly what he wanted to be when he grew up.
I wanted to be a French professor, actually. That's what
French professor, really?
Yeah, that's what I... Yeah.
Ça va?
And so, oui, ça va très bien. Et vous?
That's it.
Okay.
All right, so he gets into a French PhD program.
Doing the whole academic thing.
Mm-hmm. And then he has what I think a lot of people can really relate to is this early life crisis.
And I began to see life ahead of me of, you know, teaching French one to some students who may or may not care about the conjugation of être and avoir and really not being able to do much. And I started thinking, I want to do something else, whatever that is. I want to have some connection to what's going on in people's lives.
So Thomas totally changes course. He packs up and heads to law school at St. Louis University. And when he gets there, he becomes friends with a couple other guys, John McAnner and Michael John Boss.
By their third year of law school, Thomas and his two buddies were helping poor people work through legal issues. And much of the time, those people were black.
What did you know when you were starting about black people and about the black experience in America?
Nothing in the way that I learned after I started doing the work. I mean, I would say now if you ask me that question, I'd say I didn't know anything.
Nevertheless, Thomas and his buddies were committed to the work they were doing. And Thomas says all of their clients had the same combination of needs.
I never met a single person during my time there who I would have characterized as a criminal. These were all poor people, and they had done things that are completely rational and understandable within the context of their world in order to get along. And if people don't have health care, they sometimes use drugs to medicate themselves. If people don't have housing, they sometimes go into the Lumiere Casino to get out of the cold when it's 22 degrees outside. The results of those acts are deemed criminal acts by our legal system, and then they end up connected to the legal system. But what we knew about every person we ever dealt with was those folks needed a job. They maybe needed some treatment. They needed some housing. They needed the things that everybody needs. And they just hadn't had as much of an opportunity to get those things as, you know, most of us do.
Okay, so the three guys decide they're going to try to make their own law firm to meet these needs, help somebody find a job, help them clean up their legal past, help them get into housing. But at this point, it's just fantasy.
That is until one night they go out and grab a few drinks.
Which is how all good ideas start.
Sure.
And that was kind of the we're going to do it conversation fueled by alcohol, right? Like that was the doubling down and committing to do it moment.
We you guys have a couple of beers and figure we're going to change the world.
Yes, exactly. Three, you know, middle-class white guys standing at a bar having too many drinks saying, we're just going to do this. We know better. We have a different plan. And we didn't really have any idea what we were getting ourselves into. But we had committed to putting together the nonprofit and starting to do the work.
They know the work they want to do, create a supercharged law firm that tackles criminal, civil, and social ills. But nobody in St. Louis was doing this, so they start looking around for examples.
And I found the Bronx Defenders in New York. While I was still a law student, I called Robin Steinberg, who's the executive director and founder of the Bronx Defenders.
I have this funny habit of answering my own phone.
So this is Robin Steinberg, who started the Bronx City Defenders. It's a law firm that was already doing the stuff Thomas and his friends wanted to do. And when she gets this call, her reaction is...
To be honest, first I was amused that a third-year law student would sort of just call up out of the blue and say, hi, I want to create this office that's taken you guys 15 years to create.
What did you tell him?
What I sort of said to him was the easy thing to do in when you're starting any organization is... to have mission creep. So my advice to him then is pick something that you do really well, defend somebody as with, you know, everything you can and think deeply about what you're doing and how you're doing it. And from there, you can build everything else.
This approach to start small makes sense to Thomas and his buddies. And they get started as soon as they pass the bar exam.
Once we were sworn in, we started doing the work in September of 2009 on a very, very small basis, a handful of clients here and there.
To find those clients, they went to the St. Patrick Center, this homeless shelter in downtown St. Louis.
What we very quickly figured out was the primary legal problem these folks had was with the municipal courts. That was overwhelmingly the case. And they would say repeatedly, from the first day, I would say, they would say, this is not about public safety. They stopped me because I'm black, and they're exploiting me because I'm poor.
Did you believe them?
Yeah.
No. Didn't believe them. I mean, the burden of proof is high, and everything they told me was at odds with what I had learned in law school, in spite of the fact that I'd seen those things when I was in the city courts. It just didn't make sense to me.
That's one of the most frustrating things that I experience.
Stephen Bradley runs the African American Studies program at St. Louis University.
Nobody wants to make these things up. You don't get credit for being discriminated against. That doesn't make you feel better. So this burden of proof is only for, and I'll say this, and I could get pushback. It only works in terms of black people and race.
Amen. This is something any black person could tell you about. Mm. How frustrating it is to not be believed, especially with matters of criminal justice.
Just ask Janine Schnurl. We met her standing in the parking lot outside of one of St. Louis County's numerous municipal courts.
And at the time, she had just worked out a payment plan for a speeding ticket.
Ladue, Creve Court, wherever, it's always the same. Country Club Hills. Whenever you go to court, it's just us. And by just us, I mean African Americans.
The evidence is not just anecdotal. For example, let's take a look at traffic stops. For more than a decade, the Missouri Attorney General's office has consistently found that black drivers are far more likely to be pulled over in St. Louis County, and that's true of many places across the country.
So why, then, was it so hard for Thomas, a guy who knows all the ins and outs of this system, to believe what he was hearing?
Well, it's not really as simple as let me throw statistics up and then change somebody's mind.
This is Matthew Taylor,
Associate Professor of Psychological Sciences at the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
We met up with Professor Taylor at Marley's. It's this little sports bar a couple blocks from the Ferguson Police Department. And Taylor sometimes goes there to grab lunch or grade papers in a back booth.
And we wanted to talk to him because this idea, this extra burden of proof when it comes to black people in America, is this deeper than just race?
Humans need order. We need consistency. We need to know that we have safety in our lives. And one of the ways that we do this in the face of a world that has all sorts of threats, one of the things that we do is we form this worldview. So I know at the end of the day, in my mind, the world operates this way.
And Taylor says when you plug race into this system, this way of thinking, It just intensifies something called in-group, out-group thinking.
In-groups are going to be those groups that we feel connected to psychologically, physically, spiritually, that we feel a part of. So when I see members of a group that's not my own, I'm already kind of heightened. This is kind of the fierce tribalism that you see. We've always done this in terms of humans. My group is good, other groups are bad. I'm more likely to be empathic towards members of my own group versus some other group.
Taylor says there is some good news in all of this.
Right. These worldviews, he says, the roadmap of sorts, can be redrawn by getting to know people who aren't like you, having honest conversations with them, basically exposure. But because of the way humans are wired to make sense of the world, that can be scary.
What that's essentially doing is forcing us to suspend how we look at the world, how we know the world, and how we've structured it, and say there are other ways to do that. And at the core of humanity, it's very threatening.
All right, Tim, time to leave the bar.
Do we have to?
Yeah, we do.
We don't say that very often.
We don't, but we got to get back to Thomas Harvey.
That's coming up right after this break. All right, now's a good time to get back to Thomas Harvey.
When we left off with him, it was 2009, and he had just started a nonprofit law firm to help poor people.
And even though he was committed to the cause, he still had a hard time connecting with his clients.
So if these people were telling you, yeah, I went to court, yeah, I've been trying to resolve this, and you yourself just said you did not believe them because it didn't make sense, why didn't you believe them?
I think for the same reasons that, because they were poor and black, and I had just learned, I had just, their internal biases I have that discounted their lived experience in the first, you know, it's a year and a half that I was there. I freely admit that I wasted time resisting the truth of their lived experience. And it's something I really am embarrassed by, because we should have been doing this work before. I shouldn't have spent as much time trying to determine whether or not the endless line of human beings telling me what happened to them were telling me the truth.
Bit by bit, piece by piece, he starts making revisions to his own worldview, that roadmap in his brain, about the system he was working in and the people affected by it.
The people we got to know were just, you know, they were just people like us who had a couple things happen to them and lost a job, gotten injured on the job, had some medical bills. They were just folks that, you know, no different really at a core fundamental level than any of us who wanted to, like, have a place to live, have a job, have a car, and hang out with their family.
At the same time he's having this individual awakening, Thomas says something else begins to bug him. He starts to conclude that the web of 81 municipal courts in St. Louis County is working like one giant machine that can just deepen generational poverty, especially for black people.
And especially troubling, Thomas says, are the court fees and warrants that made it almost impossible for some people to resolve their legal issues.
That's where you get into this. We just call the forever docket, the pay docket. Well, you got assessed $1,000 in fines. You don't have the money. Come back every month and give us something forever. And if you ever miss a court date, then your warrant, then you're back into this whole system of there's a warrant for your arrest and you get jailed, you get held for a certain period of days. And I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people. And people will casually mention, it doesn't become a moment of exploration. They will casually mention they thought about killing themselves. These are people who haven't killed themselves. Casually mention they thought about killing themselves because they didn't know when they were going to be able to see their children. They didn't know where they were going to get out. They thought they'd never get out of that jail.
Around this time, Thomas and his partners at Arch City Defenders figure they'll work out a procedure to help keep poor people who couldn't pay their fines from going to jail.
They write a motion, which is basically a standard legal argument you take to a judge that would request a warrant be dismissed for people who couldn't pay.
They did this over and over again in municipal courts across the county.
But we were learning, we could have 100 lawyers going out every night to those municipal courts and defending every single person, there'd still be an unmet need. And that's when we began to think, We have to do something about this systemically, not just on an individual representation basis.
And this is when Thomas, newly enlightened, comes up against his own burden of proof. Because for many people in the legal community, there didn't seem to be big problems to solve.
We would have these conversations at, at CLE, continuing legal education events, or over drinks, or in their office. And it was essentially just, that's not happening. Or, now, so if you talk to private criminal defense lawyers, they would say, oh yeah, that's happening. That's absolutely happening. And that's a lucrative part of my private practice. Now, if you say, once the sort of, after I began really taking seriously what the human beings who were telling me what was happening, I would sort of convey that to these other lawyers. And I'd say, well, what about this? This is unjust. And then you get this at the best reaction at the time that we ever got was, well, let me pick up the phone and call so-and-so judge in that town. I know him or her. I can get that guy out. That's how it works, right?
That guy being the
client, okay. Whoever's in jail. I was like, I got a guy right now who's locked up, I'd say. Or I got a person who's locked up, and they're locked up because they can't pay. And they say, oh man, that's terrible. Let me call Joe. I can get him out.
Thomas and his partners were fed up with what they saw as individual solutions to a systemic problem. In search of advice, they headed south to get strategies from other poverty law experts. They land on the idea of writing a white paper that documents all the problems they see in municipal courts.
To collect information for the report, they start a court-watching program. Volunteers would record what they see in courtrooms and collect written testimonials. But it wasn't until 2013 that they finally had enough money to expand the project. And it just so happened that the city of Ferguson was one of three places they focused on.
Which brings us to late summer 2014, when Michael Brown was fatally shot by then Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. Thomas says it didn't immediately click that the reaction to Brown's death and municipal courts issue were linked.
We are standing here where we are disproportionately incarcerated, disproportionately uneducated, disproportionately shot down on the streets of this city. We are here because we've had enough.
And then I saw an interview, I don't remember who it was, but it was just someone who had said, why are you out here? We're out here for justice for Mike Brown. Why, okay, what else? And they were like, the police have been doing this for years, and we've been locked up, and these courts. And I thought, oh my God, there it is, and we have it.
That it was the white paper.
And so Thomas decides to quickly release the results of Arch City Defender's investigation ahead of schedule. Just a couple weeks after Brown's death, he posts it to their website and starts tweeting about it.
Journalists from all over the world pounce.
There began to be articles using the statistics from the paper, but not citing the paper.
Which one,
so, yeah, it was hilarious. All those, I was like, wow, that sounds really familiar. Vox, I see. But anyway, so then I thought, I need to start returning these phone calls from people calling to ask about this question and sort of set aside time to talk about this.
And from there, things start to snowball.
The Department of Justice opens an investigation into Ferguson's police department and courts.
Politicians vow to fix things and pass a law that limits how much money cities in Missouri can raise from traffic fines.
And the local legal community starts to feel the pressure as well.
They form the Municipal Courts Improvement Committee and put Judge Frank Vatterott in charge.
When we first started our committee, we got a lot of trouble, could use another word, from our friends who said, what are you doing, Frank? What's wrong? We haven't done anything wrong. And I think that most of those judges and prosecutors and court clerks are not biased overtly, but they didn't realize that the systems and the techniques were result in racism.
Vatterott says that realization led to changes in how the courts do business.
In the past year, his committee has helped usher in reforms that include recalling thousands of warrants and getting municipal courts in St. Louis County to agree to charge the same fines for things like speeding.
But it's worth pointing out that that's a non-binding agreement. Nevertheless, Vatterott says he's seen a shift in thinking.
Even the what I would consider the worst offenders have come around. One who I never thought would change, goes to the jail in the town that he's the judge in three or four times a week, even on a Friday night or a Sunday, and sees people right away and sees they can't make bond and lets them out. He never would have done that before. And there's still some people that are intransient, I understand, but I have been amazed and very pleased. Even when we did the uniform fine schedule and we did the recall of warrants, I thought there'd be a lot of opposition, but there wasn't at all. And I think part of it is people don't want to see their name in the paper, but also I think people have learned. This has been a tremendous lesson for all of us, even those of us who thought we were very sensitive to racial and ethnic issues. We didn't recognize that our values and our traditions and so forth were in themselves racially biased. We just did not know that. And we learned a lot.
Now, we do need to step in for a moment and take a brief detour because not everyone is buying the self-reform efforts Vaderot is talking about.
Critics like Thomas at Arch City Defender say the public should be wary of trusting the people in charge of a system they say mistreated so many for so long. On the other hand, the St. Louis County Municipal League says this effort is sincere. When we called them, they actually say municipal court reform has been hijacked by people who have long argued for consolidation among the dozens of tiny cities in the region.
Okay, but we don't want to lose, in all this back and forth, the central question of this show.
If this was disproportionately affecting white people, do you think that this would have taken so long to come to light?
I don't think it would have taken so long because the courts that have been bad are mostly in the African-American communities in our county. And those voices have never been heard as much. Those cities are small. The mayors are part-time. There hasn't been a lot of outcry. And the people that have been subjected to the abuses by these courts are not the ones whose voices are going to be heard. It's just with. But if this had happened in a Caucasian area of town where the people are locked up, you would have heard about it, sure.
There's no doubt that people are hearing about it now, though it's unclear what will happen next with municipal court reform. A Cole County judge recently struck down that new state law that limits how much money municipalities can take in from traffic fines. And then there's Ferguson itself. Just weeks ago, the city entered into a consent decree with the Justice Department.
Under the deal, Ferguson has to overhaul its police department and municipal court. Thomas says he welcomes this type of change.
But I also want the narrative to be, you lagged behind what people were saying for years, just like we did. You know, it took us that year and a half to really take seriously what people were saying. And just like every other lawyer, judge, prosecutor, elected official, community representative, business owner, everybody in this community ignored what was happening. It wasn't the DOJ that figured it out. The people already had it figured out and nobody was listening to them, because they don't listen to poor people and black people in America. St. Louis is not alone in that.
All right, so we didn't just bring you Thomas's story to start season two of We Live Here by accident.
No, we actually did it on purpose, guys.
Hard to believe, but, you know, it reminds us because we do all the stuff that journalists do when they try and report on a topic or report about a system. We do all the research.
We get all the data.
All of the
we
data.
We find the experts.
Somebody with a PhD.
Right. But one thing that we admittedly sometimes do is forget to get the real people. And that's something that we're really going to try to do better in season two.
Yeah, so we've got a lot more stories to tell. And if you like what you hear, you got to share it with your friends, right?
Share it with your friends. Go find us on iTunes. Subscribe to the podcast.
Yes.
Give us some good ratings. We love those.
Yeah, and follow us on Twitter, too. Our handle is @WeLiveHereSTL.
And keep an eye out for a new website that we'll be dropping where you can come interact with us.
And We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Shula Newman is our producer and editor and czar of St. Louis Public Radio.
Yeah. About that. Our theme music was composed by Cassie Morgan.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
St. Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.